Note about the Knox cannon train. And that brought needed weapons from Ticonderoga to Boston at the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And weather plays a part. Please welcome John Harrigan.
Thank you very much. Well, thanks for that introduction. The key operative term there is actor. Well, it's a pleasure to be here at Union House for the Sons of the Revolution and the Massachusetts Society of the Order of the Founders and Patriots of America. I'm very honored to be here. You are an ancient and honorable organization, so I consider this to be quite a notch in my belt, if you don't mind me saying. Today we're going to be talking about the Knox seizure and the winter siege of 1775 through 1776. My play on words notwithstanding, this is an important operation that I parallel with the Operation Overlord D-Day in 1944 and with Gulf War I with the moving of ordnance over to the Persian Gulf area. It's an extraordinary operation built on assumptions. Just again, my background, I guess it sounds a bit morbid, but I've been researching historical fires, historical astronomy, historical meteorology, and other historical disasters throughout my career. Amongst the things that I've been called is an old New England folklorist, a pocket historian. My favorite is a rogue nostalgian. A man from UMass Boston called me that. An ad hoc lecturer historian. I don't have letters that precede or follow my name, but in this digital day and age, I'm known as a researcher that gets his answers through not only online, through Google Books, but finding out who has information and contacting them. So in this digital age with online resources, it's a brand new ballgame, and I'm just very excited to be part of it. I have something known as the new popular public history, and basically you'll see my mantra is the past is a blast. I'm trying to bring a contemporary and invigorating view to American history. Because if it were not for contemporary genealogy, then America would have lost her grasp of her grand heritage altogether. So today's lecture, don't be afraid if you see a lot of text. This is driven by text. Trust me, you'll hear my narration. Originally, when I wrote this lecture, I've done it for an hour and 45 minutes, an hour and a half, an hour. I'm going to buzz through some slides that will be taking, showing you photographs of historical markers of the Knox expedition, so just bear with me. This is going to be driven through the Knox diaries, word for word. I give a lot of lectures about the Revolutionary War, Winters of the Revolution, Great Storms of the Revolution. Two that I'll be trotting out this year are Great Shipwrecks of the Revolution and Great Fires of the Revolution. And one thing that I've looked at in terms of the impact of winter on warfare is the distinct advantage that the colonists had over the British. The British were not prepared for the New England winter, and therefore they were holed up and battened down in Boston along the Shawmut Peninsula and refused to come out of their quarters that they seized from colonists. And if you look at the impact of winter on warfare, and George Washington was brilliant, not a good tactical battle general, but boy, could he retreat. And he showed tremendous restraint. And we won the revolution because of those two facts. But in winter, your mobility is hindered, provisions are scarce, the most important thing is staying warm and dry. Operational weapons freeze up, building hardships, disease and frostbite, and of course, morale suffers. And these are the things that Henry Knox had to deal with when he proposed this operation to General George Washington in mid to late 1775. Little thumbnail sketch of Henry Knox, born in 1750 in Boston, seventh of 10 children. He had a weight problem throughout his life, and you'll see him indirectly referring to food in his diaries. I had to tell you that, but Billy, he was an eater. He became a bookseller, well-read in artillery, extremely well-read in artillery. Talk about book smart, and he applied that to military tactics. He was a member of the Boston Grenadier Corps in 1771. Lost two fingers on his left hand while hunting in 1773. Married Lucy, and I have to be careful in this, Flucker, in 1774. And his bookstore was looted by the British after Concord in April of 1775. He decided to flee to Worcester with Lucy, and his brother joined him there later. Henry Knox, at the time of this operation, is 25. His brother Billy William Knox is 19 years old. I don't know about you gentlemen, but when I was 19, I think had my baby diapers on. I couldn't comprehend leading an operation at 19 years of age. He participated in the Battle of Bunker Hill, and he became a good friend of General George Washington in July. That's one of the caricatures of Henry Knox. So what are you looking at? Two strategic locations in Boston. Well, the colonists had lost Bunker Hill in June of 1775. The British had that overlooking, as you can see, the city of Boston with that thin Boston neck, the Shawmut Peninsula. But they decided that Dorchester Heights wasn't important, that there was no need to seize it, and the Howe brothers decided that they would leave that unopened, and it came back to haunt them. Boston, as I mentioned, was clamped down at the time. You can see the British with General Gage, are instantiated inside Boston, and then you have various forts with General Thomas, General Putnam, and General Lee, and General Greene surrounding that. So let's look at the situation here in the autumn of 1775. The British were blockaded in the port of Boston, but the colonists lacked siege guns and stormtroops. Artillery could threaten British shipping from only two places, as we discussed, Bunker Hill and Dorchester Heights. And Knox volunteers his expertise to General Artemas Ward, who scoffs at him. And he was immediately commissioned as a colonel by General Washington. And he suggested to Washington that, hey, that cannon that's up in Fort Ticonderoga that was captured in May of 1775 by Benedict Arnold and Ethan Allen, why don't we reposition it on the Heights? And we can bring it to Boston by float and by sledge. And Washington says, great idea. Well, he was laughed at until Washington said to all of his officers, no trouble or expense must be spared to obtain them. This is an operation built on assumptions. Basically, Knox wants Lake George to be unfrozen. He wants the Hudson and Mohawk Rivers to be frozen. He wants a good bed of snow to fall on the western side of the Hudson River. And then he wants the snow to thaw once he enters Massachusetts. And you know something? He got all of those wishes. Just looking at his historical record, Henry Knox was a prolific writer. And if you look at all of his writings during the Revolutionary War, I love the way that the man writes. He doesn't use a lot of flowery language. He talks in a military sense, but in plain English. And he keeps a diary during this tour, and we're going to be looking at that. One of the most marvelous things that's ever happened in my historical research career is at the Massachusetts Historical Society, looking at Knox's original diaries on microfilm. Spectacular. But he's not giving up any secrets. If he's captured and they get his diary, you're not going to learn much of the expedition because he was very wary that he was being watched. And in turn, we'll find out that he wasn't being watched. The British didn't even know he was coming. And no word got back to Boston to the British about this operation. I'm going to be talking about Arnold briefly. I'm not going to go into his expedition, but his expedition to Quebec, his failed expedition, is going on simultaneously with the Knox expedition. And we're talking about weather as well, that the only harsh weather, for all intent and purpose, that Knox experiences is a 2 to 3 foot snowstorm on Christmas. And, you know, the temperature varying greatly from the Hudson River Valley to the east coast of Massachusetts, Boston Harbor. But we didn't have much to measure the weather by. Not many people have barometers or thermometers. The only one that did have one was John Winthrop of Concord. So step-off takes place in November, and here's the plan in Knox's words, and when you see quotation marks, these are extracted directly from his diary. Move from Fort Ticonderoga down Lake George, down the west bank of the Hudson as far as Albany, then to cross the river, and down the east bank as far as Kinderhook, from whence to turn due east across the Berkshires, through Great Barrington, Monterey, Otis, Blandford, Westfield, Springfield, and so to Cambridge. Piece of cake. Step off at Cambridge on horseback with Brother William on November 16th. They're bound for New York City, and as I mentioned, they're Husky Boys, the Knox Boys, and they go through four horses each in their drive to New York City. And what they're doing is delivering a secret message for General George Washington. And as I mentioned, Knox wants unfrozen lakes but frozen rivers, and he wants a snowpack. And we know that in November, and I get my information from various amount of journals, and I will be citing them, but it's clear from November 16th through the 20th in Dedham, according to Dr. Nathaniel Ames, a moderate snow, though, takes place on November 21st. And again, here's what some of the diaries look like, the writing. So there's your intended route in a nutshell. We head due south, and then we cut and move east. And yes, you can see the terrain. You've got the Hudson River Valley. Then you've got to head over the Berkshires. Knox knew about this, a tremendous planner. And that's why he's consulting in early November with sailors in Marblehead about tackle and gear, about getting heavy equipment over the Berkshires in steep places. And again, he hadn't visited there, but he had read about it and he had talked personally with scouts. Fort Ty. Has anybody been to Fort Ticonderoga? Yeah. Fort Ticonderoga, huge fortress at the base of Lake Champlain, Lake George. And it was taken by Ethan Allen and Benedict Arnold. And I love this picture because it basically depicts the invasion and capture. It wasn't a battle. It was, yes, yes, we're here to take over the fort. Yes, come right back. Come in. Yes, please. By all means, yes, yes, you want it. It was just, they literally knocked at the door and said, get out. So, and there's a commemorative stamp. So, in December then, the expedition arrives in Albany on December 1st via the Hudson River, and they report to General Philip Schuyler. They procure sled, rope, oxen, men, boats, and provisions. So they're going to use oxen in the New York trip and over the Berkshires, and then they're going to cut over to horses for the drag, as I call it. Schuyler was ordered by Washington to assist the Knox brothers with all facets of the operation, get the expedition to and from Ticonderoga, help transport the heavy ordnance across the Berkshires. The expeditionary force reaches Fort George on December 3rd by riding on frozen, rutted roads to the southern end of Lake George. On the 5th, the rafts and boats land at Fort Ty after traveling 33 miles north on Lake George and then to the southern tip of Lake Champlain and Fort Ticonderoga. And as you'll see in a moment, the most difficult part of the entire expedition, aside from getting over the Berkshires, is the wind in their face on Lake George. The number of men in Knox's expeditionary force varies from several dozen at points to nearly 150 in Albany, and it's contingent upon the location of the cannon train. The exact numbers are unknown due to Knox's limited diary entries, but a rough guess is 80 men or 2 men for every yoke of oxen, and there are 43 pairs of oxen. So the arrival at Ticonderoga, and again, you'll see slides of graphs like this. I'm going to show you historical markers should you ever want to try to trace the route of Henry Knox. It'll take you a couple days. So if I toggle through them quickly, it's because we're short on time here. So you can see Fort Ty. Now, we've got three pieces mainly. We've got the mortar, which shoots a high arcing parabolic shot. You have the howitzer, which is a semi-arc shot. And then you have the cannon that could fire a direct shot. These are the three pieces that we're looking at. 78 pieces were salvageable. And in a moment, you're going to see parentheses because there are three types of histories. There's the Anglo-Saxon Christian history that we're revising as we speak. There's the actual history that we're trying to discover through research. And then there's the McCulloch history, David taking the license here and there. So you're going to see what David says about the operation and what I found out. I looked at the diaries. Henry said this, David says this. I believe Henry. Sorry. 78 pieces are salvageable, ranging from 4-pounders to 24-pounders. There's one 24-pounder. That's the prize of the catch here. Guns, mortars, howitzers, flints, and tons of muskets and cannonballs. So there's a nice little cachet there of weaponry to bring to Boston. Even if they weren't taking the cannons, you've got cannonballs, mortars, flints, and more. No gunpowder, if you notice. On December 6th, at Fort Place d'Armes dock near King's Store, this is near Lake Champlain, the southern end, they load 42 sleds with 16... McCulloch says 13 brass and 26, McCulloch says 27 iron cannon, 8 brass mortars, 6 iron cohorns, 3 iron howitzers, 23 pounds of, and a barrel of flints. And they loaded into 3 types of boats, a scow, a bateau, and a petty auger. It takes 3 days to move the cannon, which is 60 tons worth of ordnance, from the fort to the north shore of Lake George. In other words, you've got Lake Champlain, and then there's a bit of ground to cover before you hit Lake George. So Henry now he's the vanguard of this expedition. He's in advance. He's a day out ahead of the cannon train here. What he's doing is going to the towns and saying, I've got a mile-long cannon train coming into town. Can you bivouac us? Do you have food? Can you swap up our oxen, horses? What can you do to help out the operation? They didn't want to telegraph this because they were worried that this would get back to Boston and the British. And he leaves his 19-year-old brother, William, in charge. And William did a bang-up job. So William is in charge of all of the heavy elements, and Henry rides ahead to stage the necessary engineering tasks, as I mentioned. Horses, oxen, sleds, billets, provisions, and travel routes. Here's a diary entry, December 6th. Knox, employed in getting the cannon from the fort on board a gondola in order to get them to the bridge. Once loaded, the gondola was sailed or rowed around the peninsula of Ticonderoga and into the River Lachute, then about a half mile up to the bridge that carried the portage road across the river just below the lower falls. This was the head of navigation from Lake Champlain, and here the cannon were unloaded off the gondola while it returned for another load. And the weather is cold and above freezing. And you'll see we're moving along the route here. December 7th and 8th, Knox. Employed in getting the cannon from the bridge to the landing at Fort George. While Knox was supervising the overland movement of the cannon down the Portage Road to the Lake George Landing, the gondola was employed moving the 16 smaller pieces from Fort Ticonderoga to the bridge, where they were ready the next day. The diary for December 8th reads, ditto the mortars. In other words, they're loading. This operation is a three-day operation, and it's extensive. They have to strip the gear out of Fort Ticonderoga and load it properly and smartly into their boats. And again, those markers, one was in front of my old home in Watertown. Shove off, December 9th. Employed in loading the scow, petty auger, and a bateau, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, set sail to go down the lake in the petty auger, the scow coming after us run aground, we being about a mile ahead with a fair wind to go down, but unfair to help the scow. A scow has run aground now. They have a fierce wind in their face. The wind dying away, we went with the utmost difficulty reached Sabbath Day Point, about 9 o'clock in the evening. They went to shore. We warmed ourselves by an exceeding good fire in a hut made by some civil Indians who were with their ladies abed. They gave us some venison roasted after their manner, which was very relishing. So they meet some Native Americans who put them up for the night. They see them as not a threat, and they give them some great venison. And of course, in December 9th, we have a hazard in Lake George. The diary says, the scow had run on a sunken rock, but not in such a manner as to be irretrievable, that they had broken all the ropes which they had in endeavoring to move her off, but was ineffectual, that they had sent up to the fort for more ropes and hands and intended in the morning to make another trial. The boat is lodged on rocks. It's salvageable, though. The crew of the bateau, after having refreshed themselves, told me, as they were not very deeply loaded, that they intended to push for Fort George. This is at the southern end of the lake. And at this point, the cannon train is halfway down the lake at Sabbath Day Point. So this is the most difficult day of the operation. Accordingly, and this is from William now. Okay, William, at age 19. I jumped into the boat and ordered my man to bring my baggage, and we would go with them. Accordingly, we set out, it being 11 o'clock with a slight breeze. Ahead, the men rowed briskly, but we had not been out above an hour when the wind sprang up very fresh and directly against us. The men, after rowing exceedingly hard for about 4 hours, seemed desirous of going ashore to make a fire to warm themselves, and I, knowing them to be very exceedingly weary. They get a biting wind in their face. They just want to get out of the boats, get off the lake, button down for the night, and build a fire. The 10th, Bolton Landing. We warmed ourselves sufficiently and took a comfortable nap, laying with our backs to the fire. The next morning they started again. About half an hour before daybreak, that is about a quarter after rising, we set out, and in 6 hours and a quarter of excessive hard pushing against a fresh breeze, we reached Fort George. So it took them 6.5 hours to go about a mile and a half. New York plaques. Landfall, Fort George Village. They've completed Lake George crossing. December 11th. He arrives just after noon. Mild weather made the lake trip easier, but now snow and cold temperatures were preferred before the cannon train, which is still in the lake, began the land carriage phase of the operation. In other words, they're on sleds now. They're intending to put all the ordnance on sleds. Some wagons, but for the most part, they're dragging this on sledges. So they want frozen ground. They'd love some snow. And they're also asking for solid ice in the Hudson River, thick enough to take 1,800 pounds of weight of his largest gun across, which is that 24-pounder. The diary. On Monday the 11th, I sent an express to Squire Palmer of Stillwater to prepare a number of sleds and oxen to drag the cannon to be ready by the first snow. So Henry's making preparations of getting the sleds, and he's predicting snow, even though he has no data to support that prediction. December 12th. Again, a plea for Palmer's provisions dated December 12, 1775, Fort George. Captain Palmer, sir, I must beg that you would purchase or get made immediately 40 good strong sleds that will each be able to carry a long cannon clear from dragging on the ground, and which will weigh 5,400 pounds each, and likewise that you would procure oxen or horses as you shall judge most proper to drag them. I think that you may be able to purchase sleds that are already made, which by strengthening might do. The sleds that they are first put upon are to go to camp near Boston, the cattle as far as Albany or Kinderhook, where we must get fresh ones. So he's showing his cards there. He's saying to go to camp near Boston. And when I originally saw that, I'm saying, go to camp near Boston. Is he talking Dorchester?
Or is he talking?
Where's he going to hide the cannons when he gets there? Because he gets to Framingham in the middle of January. He doesn't put them up on the heights of Dorchester until March 5th or 6th. So he's got to hide them somewhere, from not only loyalists, but from the British. December 13th, back on the lake. Diary. On the 13th, being very uneasy and not hearing of our little fleet, we dispatched an express boat. And this is Henry now, worried about the fleet. About 2 o'clock, but in the afternoon, we received advice that on the morning of the 10th, the scow had gotten off the rock on which she had run on, and with great difficulty had reached Sabbath Day Point. And on the same night, the wind exceedingly high, the sea had beat in her such a manner that she sunk. So they did get the ordnance off of the scow, but it eventually sunk. So you've got Henry out in front, you've got the main column with Billy Knox, William Knox, and then you've got the people that are lagging behind trying to get the scow off the rocks. They saved it. They saved the ordnance. Amazingly, and you'll see it later, nobody dies in this expedition. Cannon arrives at Fort George. This is the back end of the cannon train, December 16th. Received of Henry Knox $26, which Captain John Johnson paid to different carters for the use of their cattle in dragging cannon from the fort of Ticonderoga to the north landing of Lake George, William Brown, junior lieutenant. So they pay Brown $26 for horses, or cattle, oxen. Here's a note to General Schuyler from Henry Knox on December 16th. Sir, we've been so fortunate as to get the mortars and cannon safely over the lake to this place. I arranged with Captain Palmer of Stillwater to get proper conveyances for them from here. We are apprehensive of difficulty at Albany for want of a proper scow. I am not well enough acquainted with the road after we cross at Half Moon to know whether it be practicable to keep on the east side of the river entirely to Kinderhook. Note here, they crossed the Hudson 4 different times, according to what's frozen. So that's what he's asking about. They don't want to lose a sled in the water. They do, but we'll talk about that in just a moment. So I expect Captain Palmer up with the teams on Tuesday or Wednesday, and I expect to move as far as Saratoga if the sledding continues as at present. And I think that's some dramatic irony how he's talking about Saratoga. And just 6 years later, Battle of Saratoga turns the revolution. From thence we must wait for snow. I wrote to Mr. Livingston at Albany for 500 fathoms, 3-inch rope to fasten the cannon to the sleds, and it has not yet arrived. And here's an update to General Washington, December 17th. And again, this operation, we end it in the middle of January, so we're moving along here quickly. I have made 42 exceedingly strong sleds and have provided 80 yoke of oxen to drag them as far as Springfield, where I shall get fresh cattle to carry them to camp. The route will be from here to Kinderhook, from whence into Great Barrington, Massachusetts Bay, and down to Springfield. There will scarcely be any possibility of carrying them from here to Albany or Kinderhook, but on sleds, the roads being very gullied, at present, the sledding is tolerable to Saratoga, about 26 miles. And just taking a look at the weather, it's getting very cold, and Lake George is beginning to freeze up. And be careful what you brag for and what you promise if you can't deliver it. Beyond that, there is none. I have sent for sleds and teams to come here and expect to begin to move them to Saratoga on Wednesday or Thursday next, trusting that between this and then we shall have had a fine fall of snow, which will enable us to proceed further and make the carriage easy. He's predicting snow. And then here's where he gets into trouble. If that should be the case, I hope in 16 or 17 days to be able to present Your Excellency a noble train of artillery, the inventory of which I have enclosed. So he's basically saying that by the end of the year, he's going to be in Boston. He's about a month late. So Knox goes by foot to Fort Miller on December 24th, it's Christmas Eve, and then crosses the Hudson. And in his diary, he says, where Judge Dewar procured me a sleigh to go to Stillwater. A lot of people are helping him, understanding that he's with the revolution, he's against the British. A lot of these farmers had probably had some interaction with British soldiers who tended to pillage and steal things without asking for them, whereas our government would steal things, the United States government, and then ask for them later. He then crossed the Hudson by ferry to the west side and then arrived at Saratoga, where he stopped and had dinner. And again, food. We dined and set off at about 3 o'clock. It's still snowing exceedingly fast. After the utmost efforts of the horses, we reached Ensign Tavern, 8 miles beyond Saratoga, and we lodged. So there's heavy snow falling, 2 feet in Albany. And we know that there's a furious snowstorm in Dedham as well, through Dr. Nathaniel Ames. This is a major snowstorm. And also there's a major snowstorm raging right now over Quebec. Arnold's suffering with his men, which is due north by a couple of hundred miles. So we move down Route 9. We're heading to Albany, or actually to Saratoga, Fort Edward. And again, there are markers all along the route, which is nice in this day and age that one could actually trace the route if they wanted to. Saratoga, Knox Plaque. Now, the Albany Hall. So we've got 2 feet of snow on the ground. Knox awakes the next morning, and he's delighted. So he goes to Stillwater and gets another sleigh to go to Albany. He says, the roads not being broken prevented our getting farther than New City, which is modern-day Lansingburg, about 9 miles above Albany, where we lodged. And just some points, some tactical points when I visited there, just talking about the crisscrossing. I don't want to confuse you. But basically, the main point is the Charles River is a trickle at its widest point when you compare it to any point in the Hudson. It's a vast, large, mean river. We're heading to Albany now, down the Hudson. Again, we're on the western side. Again, the markers. Here we go, December 26th, day after Christmas. In the morning, we set out and only got about 2 miles when our horse is tired and refused to go any farther. Check this out. This is a 300-pound man now. Listen to this. I was then obliged to undertake a fatiguing march of about 4 miles in snow 3 feet deep through the woods, there being no beaten path. I got to Squire Fisher's, who politely gave me a fine breakfast, and provided me with horses, which crossed me as far as Colonel Schuyler's, where I got a sleigh to carry me to Albany, where I reached about 2. I had almost perished with the cold. Deep, deep snow.
Could he commandeer things, or was this all based on the goodwill of the people loaning him?
Both. He would work the goodwill of the people. There's only one case where he commandeers something, but everybody was willing. Go get him. Go get him, boys. Here you go. Here's what I got. And you'll see when we go to Albany, whenever I drive through Albany, you always raise a glass. They saved the revolution. You'll see in just a moment. This is resource procurement. Here's Albany. Pivotal point. This is when you start heading east. General Schuyler sent out his wagon master and other people to all parts of the country to immediately set up their sleighs with horses suitable, allowing them 12 shillings per day for each pair of horses and oxen per ton for 62 miles. So it's cold, it's above freezing, and the snow on the ground begins to melt, and this is troubling. Sled teams arrive at Fort George. Sled teams arrive at the base end of Fort George. They're loaded as they arrive, and they're sent southward toward Albany. So you can see now, Knox is well out ahead of the train here. Okay, several miles out ahead of the train. The lack of continuing cold had prevented the river from freezing deeply enough to allow the sleds to cross on the ice when they reached Lansing's Ferry. It's raining in Dedham, so you can see there's a thaw underway here. Not good. January 2nd and 3rd, the sled teams now are departing Fort George. And can you imagine the spectacle of a mile long of oxen, just men walking along a wagon train with cannons strapped and piles of cannonballs to these sleds? Amazing. People just... As the guns moved, and that helped them recruit, too, when you saw the... Yeah, sure, yeah. They're not going to say no. Yeah, they can't even see the end of the train. Yeah, whatever you need. And you'll see when we get to Westfield, there's one hell of a party. When they cut over, when the New York guys get to go home, and then the Massachusetts boys pick up the train, and there's cider for all and some fine whiskey. And that was used as an enticement by Knox to get them moving. As the guns moved slowly down the road from Lake George, Knox waited in Albany for colder weather. And he even had his men trying to thicken the ice on the river by drilling holes in and pouring buckets of river water over the surface to freeze. He's trying to artificially induce freezing. And again, the melting is causing muddy and rutty roads. So now on January 4th, they make some serious time. The lead cannon train reaches Albany. First of the guns crosses the Hudson at Lansing's Ferry and arrives in Albany. On the diary, Thursday the 4th arrived a brass 24-pounder and a small mortar. So the big gun has come in. And as I mentioned, it's the prize piece of the drag. It's starting to get cold again now. Okay, so the roads now, the threat of thaw, they're starting to harden up again. Here's the January 5th update to His Excellency. Letter to Washington. The want of snow detained us for some days, and now a cruel thaw hinders from crossing the Hudson River, which we are obliged to do four times from Lake George to this town. The first severe night will make the ice sufficiently strong. Till that happens, the cannon and mortars must remain where they are. These inevitable delays pain me exceedingly, but we got over four more 18-pounders. So, again, he's hoping that the thickening of the ice permits him to get the entire train across, but at some point, he's got to hold up and make sure, he's got to ensure that the ice is thick enough for the entire cannon train to pass across so they can head on to Springfield. And he expects now that he's going to arrive in Springfield 8 or 9 days after the first severe freeze, and he's right. In fact, he gets in there ahead of schedule. And here we go. There's a loss of a heavy cannon and a Half Moon ferry. It's January 6th. Diary. In the afternoon, much alarmed by hearing that one of the heaviest cannon had fallen into the river at Half Moon Ferry. The ice is too thin, so Knox issues orders to send the remainder of the sleds to a safer crossing. At Slosses, this is another crossing point, as the ice was so much stronger there than at Half Moon, the usual place of crossing. So he changes up his plan, saying, I think the ice is thicker here at Slosses. We're going to cross here. So the new crossing is on the Mohawk, west of the Hudson, later known as Clausus Ferry or Slosses near Crescent. And another cannon goes into the drink. Another cannon slips into the river as Knox attempts to move the cannon train eastward over the Hudson to Rensselaer. The cannon, which the night before last came over at Slosses Ferry, we attempted to get over the ferry here, which we effected excepting the last, which fell into the river, notwithstanding the precautions we took. It was recovered, though. The remainder of the cannon train reaches Albany. We went on the ice about 8 o'clock in the morning and proceeded so carefully that before night, we got over 23 sleds, that's half the expedition, and were so lucky as to get the cannon out of the river, owing to the assistance the good people of the city of Albany gave. Other accounts of soldiers there say that every man, woman, and child is on the rope, pulling that rope out of the river, trying to pull that with the help. And they're pulling and pulling and pulling. Women bringing clothing, changed blankets for the men that had to actually go into the river. The entire city or village of Albany at this point is on that rope or has something to do with extracting that cannon out of the river and getting them up and on their way. So this is where I say, were it not for the willing souls of Albany, the revolution may very well have been lost. So please, next time, raise a glass to the helpful folk of Albany. John P. Becker. I have trouble with this because he's talking about alcohol and he's 12 years old, but here we go. John P. Becker, a 12-year-old lad from Old Saratoga who served with his father as a driver for the Knox on the trip from Fort George to Springfield, has left an account of the trip, which was first published in Albany, in the Albany Gazette in the 1830s. Quote, we felt an unusual degree, he's got tremendous vernacular for a 12-year-old, we felt an unusual degree of interest in fulfilling our contracts. My father took in charge a heavy iron 9-pounder, which required the efforts of 4 horses to drag it along. Others had the heavy resistance of 18s and 24s to overcome, those are the pounders, which required the exertions of at least 8 horses. We had altogether about 40 or 50 pieces to transport, and our cavalcade was quite imposing. At Lansing's Ferry near the mouth of the Mohawk River, the cavalcade tried to cross on the ice to the east bank of the Hudson. As a precaution, a 40-foot rope was tied to the first sleigh tongue, and a teamster walked alongside with a hatchet, ready to cut the rope and save the horses should the heavy gun crash through the ice. Halfway across, the ice did give way, and a noble 18 sank with a crackling noise and then a heavy plunge to the bottom of the stream. The water, fortunately, was shallow, and the gun, once again, was recovered. Third gun to go in, and they recovered. The crossing at that point, therefore, was abandoned, and they searched for another crossing point. Back to Becker. Backtracking, the train finally crosses the Mohawk at Clausus Ferry on thin ice, remains on the west side of the Hudson until Albany. One cannon was lost in the Mohawk and left there. Within 3 days, the remainder of the guns had entered Albany for the final crossing of the Hudson. We're going to go back and talk about that gun that was left in the Mohawk years later. Our appearance excited the attention of the burghers, Becker wrote. This was the first artillery which Congress had been able to call their own, and it led to reflections not in the least inferior to our cause. January 9th, Knox heading for Claverack. Having seen his train of sleds safely on their way eastward from Albany, Knox rides on ahead. I set out from thence about 12 o'clock and went as far as Claverack, about 9 miles beyond Kinderhook. A broken sleigh detained him for 2 days. Knox had a policy of delaying the entire column if but one of its components got into trouble. He wanted to travel as a unit. And you can see Arnold is suffering a snowstorm. It rains in Dedham, and in Western Mass, it's colder and below freezing. As we move down 20, split to 9, Kinderhook. Moving out of town, Taconic State Parkway crossing. Green River. See the border there? And here we go, and I apologize for the font. Early historians determined that the route through Claverack was due south on the post road, Route 9H, to the present village of Claverack, and the east route on Route 23 into Massachusetts. That's the route marked by the Knox Trail monuments erected in 1927. But research done in the early 1970s suggested a more southeasterly route from Kinderhook toward the Massachusetts border above North Egremont and then on to Great Barrington. Now, this summer I got a chance to camp out in Otis. I got to walk on the untrodden route of Henry Knox, an old trail, to my wife's chagrin, bring extra off, and wear sunglasses because of the flinging tree branches when your husband's in front of you, forgetting who you are. But I went down this trail to see, and I was walking back in time. I was walking the trail of the Knox expedition that isn't known, and it's quite exhilarating. It's not a pavement. It's not where these stone markers are. I was actually experiencing what some of the men might have experienced on their route. Living history. We're in Massachusetts, January 11th. Knox takes the hazardous military trail used only by a few others. This is the one that I took, which headed east over the Berkshires, through Great Barrington, Otis, and to Springfield on what is now modern-day Route 23, a treacherous road for motorists even today. He used 80 oxen in place of horses. The weather is clear and cold on January 11th. And then this is majestic here, and I got to this point. We reached number one, and he's referring to Monterey, Massachusetts, after having climbed mountains from which we might almost have seen all the kingdoms of the earth. This, then, is the end of the known Henry Knox diary entries. From this day forward, the operation goes dark. They're in Massachusetts. Now, we can piece this together, what happened afterwards, through the memoirs of Henry Knox and also of people that were on that expedition. But what happened is treacherous greenwoods. They plunged into a 12-mile stretch called Greenwoods. It was made dreary and forbidding by dense evergreen forests. Knox passed through what is now known as East Otis and reached Blandford, where more trouble awaited him. The descent of Glasgow, which is Westfield Mountain, had to be made. It required 3 hours of arguments by Knox to assure the Hudson Valley Teamsters that the treacherous trip down could be made without danger from runaway weighted sleds plummeting downhill upon them. So he's talking these guys down the hill. He supervises the precautionary measures taken, such as drag chains, poles thrust under runners, check ropes anchored to one tree after another. And again, block and tackle idea came from consulting with Marblehead sailors. It's cold and below freezing. And there's a depiction, famous. You can see the men slipping and sliding. He actually collapsed wheels. I like the way he does this here. He's smart. Another man might have kept the wheels there. He just disassembled the cannon and slides it down. He uses gravity to his advantage. And that's another thing that he used. He used gravity. He didn't try to go against the weather or the terrain. So the train now lumbers into Westfield. Young Becker. Our armament was a great curiosity in Westfield. We found that few, even among the oldest inhabitants, had ever seen a cannon. We were great gainers by this curiosity, for while they were employed in remarking upon our guns, we were, with equal pleasure, discussing the qualities of their cider and whiskey. At an inn that evening, Knox was surrounded by local visitors, all of whom seemed to be officers in the militia. What a pity, Knox said, that our soldiers are not as numerous as their officers or our officers. Everybody was an officer. So there's a party, there's a cutover, the Teamsters are heading back to New York, the Massachusetts guys are coming. Springfield now, January 16th, we're almost there. At Springfield, there was the broad Connecticut River to cross. The ice held, but on the far side, the noble train of artillery bogged down in the mud of a sudden thaw. Knox paid off the drivers from New York State there and hired native Teamsters. The New Yorkers went home, Massachusetts men took over. Oxen yokes were now replaced with horse teams, and when the ground froze again, he pushed on.
Where did Knox get the money? Was this supplied to him?
Yes, Washington. You'll see it. And what a bargain. Wait till you see what this costs at the end. So there's basically your timetable. December 5th, Ticonderoga. It takes nearly a month, 25 days to get to the end of Lake George for the train. And then they pick it up. Christmas in Albany, okay? Knox is there. The train actually reaches Albany on the 4th. And then it gets to Claverack. And they make really good time, only a week to Springfield. And they get to Framingham by January 19th. So we're moving eastward. Okay, there you see the modern-day Turnpike, Wilbraham, Warren, Brookfield, Spencer, Leicester, into Worcester, Shrewsbury, Northborough, we're on Route 20 now, Marlborough, Southborough, along 20, deviate to 9, Potter Road. And here we are. We're in Framingham, January 19th. And who's there? John Adams. John Adams is there. Knox temporarily deposited most of the heavier pieces in order to rush the more portable cannon to Washington and Cambridge. By the way, all those generals that scoffed at him were amazed when they heard, when word got in. They elated. Green, especially. Washington was considering, well, I can tell you a little bit about Washington. They temporarily deposit most of the heavier pieces in order to rush the more portable cannon to Washington and Cambridge. A couple things here. Number one is, this is the end of the operation, January 19th. We're going to see in just a moment. They don't go to Dorchester until March 5th. Well, what's going on for a month and a half? Just can't leave it out in the streets in Framingham. They had to hide it somewhere and store it somewhere. And I've theorized with some historians, D. Michael Ryan, Boston College. He thinks that maybe it was clandestinely dragged to Fort Washington, which one of my earlier slides, it was just south of the Charles River, and hid there because the British weren't coming out. Moreover, the Loyalists, who for all intent and purpose had been chased more towards Boston proper. And it makes sense that if it were in a fort, they'd have a 24-hour sentry and that nobody would get through, and that they hid it in some sort of a depot before they moved it to Dorchester. That only makes sense, but that's one of the mysteries of this entire trip. What happened in those 45 days? Where did they store the cannon? And when they gave the word to go, and they were up in Dorchester Heights in about an 18-hour period, it had to be close to Dorchester. So Washington now is considering an over-ice attack on Boston. And as I mentioned, Washington showed great resistance. Wanted to attack New York his entire military career during the Revolution, but held back. But he's jumping up and down on the ice of Boston Harbor, looking from Dorchester towards Boston, because raiding parties of the British had come over and burnt tent encampments in Dorchester and killed some soldiers. He's jumping up and down to see if that ice is thick enough to march across. Thank goodness he didn't. The weather is cloudy on the 19th of January. So now, Route 126, we're in Framingham, moving to Weston. Okay, these are the markers now. And again, this is highly speculative. I have to tell you, these markers, even how do they know that he actually took this route or what cannon came via this route? It's all hearsay. And then where I live in East Watertown. And again, the markers basically say through this place past General Henry Knox in the winter of 1775-76, to deliver General George Washington at Cambridge a train of artillery from the Fort Ticonderoga used to force the British Army to evacuate Boston. So here we go. Here are the expenses. For expenditures in the journey from the camp round to Boston to New York, Albany, and Ticonderoga, and from thence with 55 pieces of iron and brass ordnance. Not 57, David McCullough, 55. This is the bill. One barrel of flints and 23 boxes of lead back to camp, including expenses of self, brother, and servant, 520 pounds. And he came in under budget of 1,200 pounds.
Probably the last time the government has ever come in under budget.
That's right. That's why this is also a benchmark expedition. So here's the Cambridge encampment, okay, and here's, now we're talking Fort Washington. Here's where I think they were stowed away. That's my theory. Because if you look, well, you can look, you have to cross over the Charles and get to Dorchester. So now look at Dorchester Heights. We're there, okay, and we can see where breastworks are dug in here, and they build breastworks up here as well, ramparts.
we're dug in here, and here's where the British are. And of course, this is all filled in.
I think, are we in an area that's Back Bay?
No, we're still on the hill.
Okay, so we're still up on the hill. So, but the neck there.
The neck is where Back Bay is.
Okay. Yep. Speaking of things sinking, but we won't go there about the Red Sox. So it's March 2nd through the 5th, 1776. They're getting ready for this operation. And just a weather account from Maine. Reverend Thomas Smith says, January this month, like the two past, has been constantly and severely cold. The wind has been westerly all winter. February, a dismal snap of cold weather. So just to give you, Arnold Expedition was 529 miles from Newburyport to Quebec City. I'm not going to go over the Arnold Expedition. It's another lecture at another time, but basically, this expedition, they were eating Arnold's dogs halfway in through the expedition. They had a hurricane in Maine. We were talking about gentlemen earlier today. There was a rainstorm, a maelstrom that was encountered by the Arnold Expedition. A man driven by ego and didn't like to plan things out. By the time that they got to Quebec, it was game, set, and match. His signal that he did to General Montgomery was to fire off a flare to signal that the attack will begin. You know, the British were right across the river, could see the same flare and knew what it stood for. So, but that's another story. There were so many blizzards. Just to give you, there was a 20-foot snowdrift in February during a blizzard in Quebec during the Arnold Expedition. Unheard of. So let's look at the artillery placement on the heights. We're closing up here, just a couple more slides. Washington moves his men into Dorchester Heights in preparation for cannon installations there on March 2nd through the 5th. It's not really an overnight operation. They're doing it in piecemeal. They don't want to call attention to themselves, and they're doing it at night, moving, preparing their way to move up the hill. Knox's artillery was maneuvered into position on Dorchester Heights really on the night of March 4th. 2,000 men assisted in the disassembly and reassembling of the artillery pieces. A star was used to muffle the sound of the cannon carts and trolley. So it was, they muffled the tires. They wrapped the tires with a muffling substance. And by March 5th, 1776, they were firing at British positions. So, after seeing the rebel batteries in place, General Howe made half-hearted plans for taking the heights on the night of March 6th. But he said, we're going to go up there and take those right off the hill. They weren't going. They didn't just look at the cannonade and say, oh, well, we're surrounded. Time to leave. They say, we're going to take that right away from you. We're going up tomorrow. But as Providence would happen, a huge, tremendous wind and rainstorm, something that I call a gully washer, or what was described as a hurricane, came and caused him to abort his attack. It rocked the ships, damaged the ships where his troops were lodged, and made most of them seasick. Couldn't even stand up straight. So he decided then on March 9th to evacuate the city about a week later with his 7,000 men. But he said, you fire on us, I will burn this city to the ground, every last dwelling. And Washington decided to hold that line. It was an honorable thing to do, not fire on the British fleet. So they left undisturbed. And there were some deaths here, too. According to Nathaniel Ames and Boyle's Journal of the Occurrences, on March 10th now, this is well after the 5th and the 6th, four men were killed at Dorchester by a cannonball. The night before, 9 o'clock on Saturday the 9th, several forts in Roxbury began to bombard the town of Boston. One Dr. Dole and three privates, having imprudently kindled a fire on Nook's Hill, which is in Dorchester at the Heights, as they were settling in by it, were all killed by a cannonball from the enemy's lines, who kept up a severe cannonade most of the part of the night. So at 1 p.m. on March 17th, at that point when the British evacuated, Washington sent in 1,500 men who had had smallpox. In other words, they had already had smallpox and they were immune to the disease because there was an outbreak of smallpox at this time in Boston, to take control of Boston, and the British were gone. Wrap up here. Scorecard. 59 guns or 55, depending on what you say. 59 according to McCullough, 55 according to Knox's Bills. Went 300 miles in 56 days. That's 5.5 miles per day. One gun tube was lost through the ice in crossing the Mohawk River and was not recovered for a century. A feud between competing families saw the cannon thrown back into the river in 1909, only to be excavated again in 1996. The second cannon made it to Boston, was displayed at the Bunker Hill Monument, broken up for scrap during World War II, recovered, restored, and then returned to Fort Ticonderoga. No men were lost. Less than six beasts of burden were lost. I know the four were eaten. And only one major snowstorm was encountered. That was on Christmas. So to wrap up the actual route, it followed modern Route 23 east out of Great Barrington for a few miles down Knox Trail Road until it intersected Route 20 west of Westfield, then along Route 20 through Springfield, Wilbraham, Palmer, and onto Route 9 at Warren, then along Route 9 to Brookfield, Spencer, Leicester, and Worcester. Then the path went back onto Route 20 to Shrewsbury through Northboro, Marlborough, and Southborough. From there it passed Framingham, Wayland, Weston, Waltham, and Watershown, finally entering Cambridge on January 24, 1776. So that's the Knox Trail, the way it was laid out. And again, the expedition would have failed. It would have failed in the winter of 1775 because it was so warm and no snow. And it would have gone smoother in the winter of 1777 because it was so brutally cold. So that's my talk for today. You've been a great audience. I appreciate it. My sources are numerous, Ludlam and other sources. But this man had the vision and the gall, and I appreciate you being here today. Thank you. Now you can hear me jump into my hockey announcer's voice, so I hope that I didn't slam some sentences together. I will take any questions at this time.
So how long did it take Washington to promote him to general? Was he colonel for a while, or did he get promoted?
When he made Framingham, he was general.
Oh, really?
Well, he wasn't named officially then. I think that the pomp and circumstance took place in April of 1776. I have to look at that. I'm speculating. But at that time, during the operation, he was a colonel. And Washington relied on him heavily. Even the British feared him because he knew artillery so much. Yes?
You said they didn't pick up powder at Ticonderoga.
No.
They had it on hand?
They had, where they had stashed it. Now, that was secret because, as you know, that's where the British were searching. The locations were secret where they had it stored, but they did have it in limited amounts, limited quantities on hand.
Any other questions?
Yes, sir.
One of my wife's ancestors was on that.
Sure.
He's the young officer leaning on the cannon.
Wow.
Ebenezer Stevens, yeah.
Oh, that's
a lineage. He studied with Knox down in Newport in his bookstore. And we understand he was with him on that expedition.
Wow.
So it was really incredible. Story.
So I live next to Framingham, so I'm just sort of curious. Was there cannon stored in Framingham, or was that just the final resting place?
It was staged. It was resting point. That was the end of the expedition. At that point, the men went back to their homes. The Teamsters went back to their homes, and it was moved. There was another clandestine operation. Again, I'm trying to get my arms around. What did they do with the cannonade? Where was it, the depot? How did they store this? They probably did it so they didn't want to draw attention to themselves. The British literally never knew about this, and nobody ratted them out either. So it was a clandestine operation, very secretive, and to this day, it's pure speculation as to how they moved them into place. We do know.
The British were all in Boston, right? I mean, there were.
Yes.
And there was a siege around Boston, so how would the loyalists have even gotten the information to them?
Through disguise. There was information. Knox was known for getting in and out of Boston.
Okay.
There were ways of doing it through females, but there was definitely information of getting in and out of Boston, for sure. Yes?
So many talks. Quickly, your experience as a hockey announcer, I'm curious to know, is this sort of the background?
25 years, my 16th season with the Boston Bruins alumni.
Right.
I'm a charity hockey announcer. For instance, we'll be 7 o'clock on a Friday night in Portland, Maine, a 1 o'clock in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and a 7 o'clock in Providence. I've filled in the American Hockey League, East Coast Hockey League, International Hockey League, Boston Garden National Hockey League. And as I told these gentlemen, I never really got the job. I've just been filling in for somebody they never told me about. So I'm very, very lucky and blessed as in lucky, not as in gifted, to travel with these guys because they're... When I first started doing it, it was to protect the legacy of the old-time Boston Bruins.
Yeah.
And now it's just hanging out with my friends. So it's a very, very nice life. Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
John, on behalf of the Fathers and Patriots, Sons of the Revolution, what's the other one?
Colonial Wars, I believe, and all here present.
1812.
War of 1812. We'd like to present you with this book.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
See how I immediately saw the camera and I paused.
This way.
More ham here than Easter Sunday.
Keep going. Keep going. Can you cut
I think
that
he wants us to.
Thank you. The waltz position. I think I got you. Thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Dave, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Have a great day. Keep up the search, too.
So this portrait, during the revolution or after the revolution?
During.
During.
Yeah. You can tell he lost a few pounds during the stress.